We're really happy tonight to have Timothy McDonald joining us, and Tim has just completed, or at least it's just out, a book called The Whole Forest for a Backyard. Tim grew up at the edge of the BWCAW, the Boundary Waters Wilderness. He recently retired after spending 29 years teaching English to deaf and hard of hearing students in suburban Minneapolis. He now spends time writing, doing volunteer work for a Twin Cities nonprofit that helps individuals transition out of homeless shelters and into independent situations. He loves fly fishing, kayaking, and canoeing. And Tim, I want to welcome you to the Roadhouse.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to have you. Of course, you spent most of your childhood here, just about all of it.
Well, my wife would say I'm still in my childhood, we're in town, so I guess that stands to reason.
Yeah, absolutely. I was so impressed in reading this book about how you caught the flavor of being a young person in that setting that you lived in. And your parents bought a lodge called Gateway Lodge, which is now Hunger Jack Lodge. They bought it in 1958. You were three.
I was going to be three. They bought it. They took possession of it in spring of 1958, and I have a late summer birthday, so I was two going on three. And at the time, I was a kid with a big imagination, and I don't think I ever outgrew that. And so Gateway Lodge was a wonderful place to be a kid with that kind of background, you know, with imagination going into the picture. And I don't believe I ever got over living there. Mm-hmm. And it sticks with you.
Yeah, that sense of place. And you also had you had a lot of brothers and one sister.
Yeah.
To hang out with.
Yeah, poor Kath. She's got five brothers and just one sister, but she's a saint, so she makes up for in personality what she doesn't make up for in numbers.
Yeah, exactly. Getting back to growing up in a place like that, I know that I've always appreciated the Gunflint Trail for the community that it's always been I've been young.
It is unique. It's as unique as it is beautiful. I mean, think of all the businesses that are on the Gunflint Trail. And it is, you know, you go 60-some miles of road and there's no billboards. You don't have to compete with one another. It isn't a cutthroat bunch of people out to get the other guy. They're cooperative ever since the inception of the Gunflint Trail Association, and that's been around for more than 75 years.
Yeah.
Think about it.
Everybody seemed, even though they may not always be happy with each other, they always work together to get things done. It's hard to explain that to people who might grow up in suburbia.
Right, right. If it wasn't for suburbia, none of us would be in business here.
Well, there's that, too. Yeah.
Got to have a place to escape to, but also a place to escape from.
Yeah, and you didn't need to escape anywhere.
No.
In the kind of idyllic childhood that I read about in your book. And as I mentioned, I was impressed by how you were able to bring those stories, those many stories of your childhood, out, the memory that you have, but also your writing style, that I could just picture these kids doing all the things you were doing because of the way you wrote it.
And thank you.
Because of that, you know, I have one passage, if you don't mind reading.
I would love to.
I'll intro it just a little bit while I hand you this book. I think I've started on that.
Right. Okay.
And I know I just warned you about 2 minutes ago that I was going to do this. But
that's quite all right.
As far as the start of this story, you and your brother Chris got to go to the mailbox every day to pick up the mail.
Well, we didn't do it every day, but this was a special day.
A special day. And along the way, you'd bring your sleds because you had a nice downhill slide on the way home when you'd go past and hear you talk about Walt's place. Old Walter Bunn, who was also listened to you whenever you're on the phone.
All right. Privacy is a relative term when you have a party line. Try as I may, I cannot recall a time when I did not know these woods. Walt was a world champion gossip, a bit of an old crank. He was one of the other telephone numbers on our party line, and he used to listen in on everyone else's conversation. Soon, the two of us were in a position to crest at the crest of the long hill near the gravel pit. We almost forgot, cold in our anticipation and our bravado. "Betcha I can get all the way to Leo Creek before stopping," Chris challenged. "No fair dragging your feet in the turns. If you wipe out, you lose," I replied. I had the mailbag tucked in between my parka and my sweater. "You go first. You're fun to watch." "Goodbye, cruel world," Chris hollered. With that, he was off, picking up speed. I could hear him let out a few wild whoops before he turned out of sight. My turn now. I pulled down on my balaclava, and I pulled up on my parka collar. I made sure that the tow rope was under my belly where it would not get caught in the sled runners. Here goes nothing. Almost at once, my eyes blurred with tears and a rush of cold air. It was no longer any surprise to me why the downhill skiers wore such goofy-looking goggles. I thought about how goofy I would look wearing my swim mask, and then I wished I had it. The snow was hard-packed and smooth, perfect for sledding. "I gotta keep my feet up," I reminded myself. Then there would be more of a chance of making it past that long, flat stretch between hills by Leo Lake without stopping. As much as possible, I tried to follow the tracks Chris left behind. There was no salt or grit sand on the snowy road. If you could not make it up those hills in winter back then, you and your car either stayed home or learned all about fighting the tire chain demons. The wind was wicked. No doubt Chris would give me a hard time and grief about crying if he had seen my face. Of course, his eyes had blurred up too. I thought if only I had just a little more speed, momentum would take me up the next hill. I slowed a bit right before coming to the crest. Then I was on my way. Yee-haw! I coursed through a bit of an S-curve and then came barreling down the hill by the turnoff to Walt's place. That was exactly where Dad sent me airborne the winter I was 5 when he got the crazy notion to pull us kids on the toboggan hitched to the old station wagon. I was the only kid riding as Dad came down the hill and gunned the engine so the toboggan wouldn't hit the back bumper. I went flying and landed in a snowbank. Mom thought I was dead. Pulled me out of the snow and called a permanent halt to such foolish fun. I wondered what she would have thought of our sledding and figured it was just as well she was not watching. It was a good thing we had no traffic to contend with on the road in the winter. Then I saw Chris. He was almost at a dead stop. He was trying to inch his sled a little bit farther just on sheer willpower. I pulled in right beside him. We were a bit less than 20 yards from where the culvert for Leo Creek runs under the road. "Pretty darn close," I gave him. "Close enough," he returned.
Thank you, Tim. That was great. You know, you have many stories like that throughout the book that really give a sense of place and a sense of place for kids to grow up. And it was a quieter time then.
It was. It was a very quiet time. And we made our own fun. When you've got five brothers and one sister, or four brothers and one sister, how many do I have? when you've got such a large family, you always have a playmate. We live 32 miles from town, so we had to make our own fun.
Absolutely. It was a family business, obviously, and,
yep.
And you all had to kick in to make that thing work. It was kind of, home was also your business. So
yeah, in the morning, Mom and Dad crossed the road from our cabin home to the kitchen, to the office, respectively, and that was it. That was her commute in the morning.
And she created three meals a day for all the guests.
Yes, we were American plan. Every cabin rental came with three meals a day, American plan style, in the dining room of the lodge. And that was a treat in itself because everything in the resort was pretty much handmade, from the candle holders to the light fixtures. Everything was just it was part arts and craft museum and part taxidermist's place, and it was just a wonderful place for people. They enjoyed it. and if they could put up with a bunch of pesky kids running around, it was great.
Now, you had another image in that book, and I'm not going to ask you to read this one, but okay. See if you remember this little story about sitting on your dad's lap. And
yes, yeah. At the end of the evening, Mom and Dad became Mom and Dad again. They didn't have to put on anything other than themselves, because dealing with the guests was done. And they often would chat in the kitchen. Mom was of course finishing up her kitchen chores, and Dad would sit on a stool and chat with her. And one of my favorite memories from that time was crawling up on his lap, as I used to once in a while, and Dad would be drinking his Hams beer, and occasionally he'd tousle my hair, and we had a symbiotic relationship at the time, because Dad would burp, or Dad would sip the Hams and I'd burp. So I guess we had a connection somehow there.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's so funny. And as I mentioned, the family business part of it, your mother was a pretty amazing lady.
You mentioned earlier when you did the weather report, Dick, that someone's looking out for us. I think up there, hopefully she is too.
She passed away not long ago.
In April, middle of April. She had a massive stroke subsequent to some radiation therapy. She was with my wife and myself for 6 weeks during the radiation therapy, and that wasn't what got her. It was a stroke, and she went very, very quickly. Immediately after a long lingering goodbye to her sister, who's 93, older sister, and she was ready to head back up here, and wham, she went quickly and painlessly, and we can never plan that, but I think that's probably she wouldn't have mind having, if she did plan it, she wouldn't have mind going that way. Mm-hmm. She was an amazing lady.
Well, of course, there's a huge loss for you to lose your mother, but it was a big loss for the community as well.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Everybody knew Betty and all her energy. But a stroke was... that your father had was really a turning point in
your
life.
That was a whole different deal. The stroke was massive, and in, he was 54 years old. It was 1970. It didn't kill him. It took him 20 years of being disabled and having many strokes during that time. We were all up here. We had to unload the lodge in 1970, and at that time we had started being snowbirds. We were in Florida in the winter and Gunflint Trail in the summertime, and it meant losing the lodge. So we had at that time a furniture business in Pompano Beach, Florida. So I ended up during my high school years being a student in Florida, and all my summers were up here. But Dad was disabled, and after I graduated from high school, the whole family moved up here. My older brother and sister were already up here going to college. And I decided that there's no way I wanted to stay in Florida. My heart was in Minnesota. So Mom kind of figured that was going to be true for all of us. So she sold the place in Fort Lauderdale, moved back to Grand Marais.
Now, that the health problem that your father suffered, you were, what, ninth grader?
So I was going, it was a few weeks before I started my ninth grade year of high school.
And that's a very tough age, you know, just to be living normally, but to have everything disrupted in your life, your sense of place, your sense of where you're going.
Well, who in the world, or at least in America, has a normal ninth grade year?
Well, yeah. And then you add this calamity, family calamity.
Yeah.
And I know from reading the book that you were bitter about what happened.
I was for quite a long time, and then I realized that, this is, God had some kind of plan. I didn't see it at the time, but I think in retrospect, it was maybe a humbler for all of us. Maybe it was something designed to make us realize what the wilderness really was for all of us, because we got separated from the wilderness for a while. It was a double whammy for my family, because we lost the lodge and we lost the normalcy of Dad. He was still around, but he was nowhere. It took the better part of out of him. I mean, there's no better. There's no easy way to say that. Mm-hmm. It took. My dad was a very loquacious, very personable fellow, pre-stroke, and it took most of that out of him. And yes, I was bitter for quite a while.
And of course, at this time, here you are dealing with all that normal people deal with in ninth grade, as you mentioned, and also with the family loss, but also dealing with your father. Everything changed. Now suddenly, you know, you have to help him
with
his toiletries. And
well, yeah, I mean, it's a complete role reversal. You know, you come into the world and your parents are doing everything for you, and all of a sudden, you know, you're right in the heart of your teenage life, where you kind of want to break free and be on your own anyway, and you're doing everything for, you know, you and your siblings and your mother are doing everything for your father. It's a game changer. That's a big
And when you were 52, you sat down on a wilderness shore and wrote a letter to your father.
I did. This was a bit bizarre because I'd already lost my dad. My dad passed away in April of 91, a couple months before I was married. He passed away in the nursing home here in Grand Marais. And when I became the same age as my dad, that my dad was when he had his stroke, I happened to be kayaking, as I do on Lake Superior quite. That's my happy place. And I was I was in a tent when a terrific storm came up, and without getting maybe I shouldn't say this, but without becoming Shirley MacLaine, I would have to say that I had kind of an interesting experience of the presence of my father, or at least the presence of his spirit. I'm not easily given to tears, but memories flooded me, and there were definitely tears. And I don't know if I dreamt or if I slept at all that night, but before daybreak, I had written in my journal a letter to him, and I made a copy of it, so I'd always have that with me. And then after the storm passed, and morning broke beautifully, as it can only do on an island in Lake Superior, I built a simple censer meant for incense, but in this way it was meant to send something up into the spirit world, and it was a copy of that letter I burned, sent up to my father.
It was a very moving part of the book, and also a very... it left a feeling that this book is something that maybe you do, not just you did for your dad and for yourself and your whole family.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, it was something that I wanted my mom to see before she passed.
Sure.
And it came out June 1st, and mom passed in the middle of April of this past spring. But she saw and read, and I believe held close to her heart the sloppy copy, the manuscript draft of it, and I was able to give a copy to her older sister, my Aunt Mabel.
Great.
And it was very appreciated. So it was for family as well, not just mom, the rest of the family.
We've been speaking with Timothy MacDonald, and Tim has just completed as he said, in June it came out, a book called The Whole Forest for a Backyard, a delightful book, a great story of a place and a family and the tribulations that people go through. Tim, I want to thank you so much for joining us
here
tonight.
Thank you, Buck.
It's great to have you.
For having me. And
where can people find your book?
It's all over town. If I may, I'll tell you what stores are in.
Go right ahead.
Kaneda. Stone Harbor, Nanabijou, Birchbark Books and Gifts, and Drury Lane. And also, Eric Humphreys has them over at the Lake Superior Trading Post. So they're all over town, and we encourage you to purchase local. If you're interested in the book, you know, the local people, that should be your first bet.
Thank you very much. That was Tim McDonald, everybody.